smoothly, that we hold adults accountable and give them the opportunity to change their lives so that they can return to our communities to lead productive, crime-free lives. When I arrived in the agency, to the agency back in 2004, I learned quickly that it really is filled with super passionate people making positive change in the lives of those in our care and custody. And it's a tough job. You just heard some of those wellness statistics. It's dangerous, it's stressful. And you'll hear me talk more about the impacts of the stress later today. Our staff often put their safety on the line, and yet they come to the table every day with our core values in mind, working to get to our 10-year vision. As you are aware, this agency has managed through some difficult times, some difficult headlines since we've met last. So recognizing the need to really become more transparent and to empower our employees to move the organization forward, we implemented a performance-based management system. And we really intend to ensure a clear process and level of accountability for every program inside our organization. And of course, we always do this with public safety as our top priority. And last but not least, we work collaboratively with many of our partners and stakeholders from across our public safety system, and I am so grateful for our collaboration with our community corrections partners, with our labor organizations, both AOCE and AFSCME, our relationship with the District Attorney's Association, the Chiefs of Police, the Sheriffs, and advocates like Victim Advocates, Partners for Safety and Justice, CURE, Disability Rights Oregon, and Basic Rights Oregon, not to mention the thousands of volunteers that come into our prisons every day. So as we move forward, we know that you're going to have incredibly difficult budget decisions to make for the 17-19 budget, but DOC staff are strong and resilient, paying very close attention to the difficult decisions you're going to have to be making, and I just want you to know I'm honored to work with all of them. This is our tentative schedule for the week. While he won't be presenting this week, I would like to introduce our new Deputy Director, Brian Bleck. Brian has stepped into this interim role in a very smooth fashion, bringing instant credibility given his impeccable service to the agency for almost 34 years. And I want to thank him publicly for stepping into this role. We have a lot of information to cover over the next few days, and we will do our best to keep those presentations moving on schedule. In order to keep on schedule today without compressing the rest of the week, I will actually need to make it through my presentation, and Mr. Gower will need to make it through his. So as you look at this, we actually need to get to slide 58 to stay on target. So this is a table of contents for your reference, and I will get started by providing an agency overview. It's always good to start with our foundation, our mission. We promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. Our mission is what we do every day. It's what we are based on. Whether we are working directly with the adults in our custody or those on supervision or providing those backbone services, we all have a very specific role to play. So the first part of our mission is something that we have refined over the years. Yet, holding offenders accountable for me is more than simply carrying out the court's orders and removing these individuals from society. Holding them accountable really means helping them acknowledge and take responsibility for their behaviors and their actions, and to make commitments for positive change. And I'm going to talk about more about that in just in a minute. The second half of our mission is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will not commit another crime after release. What this means for me, especially as a former victim's advocate, is that another victim is not created once they leave our care and custody. And what we do ties right back to the Oregon Constitution. First and foremost, we must protect the public. Secondly, we hold offenders accountable and require them to take personal responsibility, both for their crimes, to their victims, and for their behavior once they're inside our institutions. And third, we allow for rehabilitation and reformation through our programs and services. So this combination really ultimately should lead to that successful reentry back to our communities. Part of our success depends on this implementation, the implementation of our primary business strategy, which we refer to as the Oregon Accountability Model. So inside the organization, we use data to determine risk in order to appropriately case plan. We foster a culture of accountability and respect. We focus on evidence-based programs. We focus on children, families, and transition. And while then in the community, we focus on appropriate treatment, sanctions, and support. Our team is made up of approximately 4,600 professionals throughout the state, most of whom fall into these four divisions. But we also have six work units outside of these divisions who report directly to the director's office. So you will learn about each of the four divisions from the respective assistant directors throughout the week. And for now, I will describe our six work units that report directly to the director's office. All of these units, which are noted on this slide, really play an integral role in ensuring that we operate effectively and efficiently, that we maintain transparency, that we hold ourselves accountable, and achieve our mission. And I want to briefly touch on each one of these units. The Office of the Chief Financial Officer has been really the guiding force as we've managed through the last 10 years of an extremely difficult budget climate. I'm pleased to have my CFO, Steve Robbins, at my side today, ready and willing to answer all of your questions. And publicly, I would like to thank him and his team for their tremendous work over the years. This office oversees quite a bit. They oversee contracts, payroll, accounting, procurement, inmate banking. More familiar to you, they manage the biennial agency budget, fiscal analyses for our policy packages, and fiscal impact pricing for all new bills that have a potential impact on the agency. The Office of Communications is charged with directing internal and external communications, media relations, legislative and government relations, public record and information coordination, and rules coordination. They are also the ones responsible for getting you the information you need and when you need it. The administrator of this office is Elizabeth Craig. She's in the audience today, a face familiar to all of you, and I am very grateful for her and her team's work. The Office of Government Efficiencies, led by Administrator Gina Rainey, is a data-driven unit that provides the agency's executive team with critical information for decision-making, and it ensures the department's mission, strategic direction, and programs are very closely aligned. The office oversees our performance-based management system, process improvement, change management, and our research and evaluation unit. The Office of the Inspector General provides a very important oversight function on behalf of the state and has the authority to report directly around me to the Secretary of State, the Governor, and the Oregon State Police. And that checks and balances, I think, is very important as you're looking at the safety and security of our prisons. With the leadership of Inspector General Craig Prinz, this unit conducts internal investigations involving staff, the adults in our custody, contractors, and volunteers. They also cooperate with local law enforcement on their criminal investigations. They conduct the inmate hearings for conduct violations, and overall they ensure compliance with the department's rules, policies, and procedures. One other function of this office is to coordinate the department's Prison Rape Elimination Act efforts. Now, the new federal PREA standards were released in 2012, and I am proud to say that we have passed all of our internal audits. The direct oversight of our agency, our employees, and those in our care and custody are extremely important to maintain ethical and secure and safe operations. I really appreciate the Inspector General's leadership and his team's good work. Our internal audits unit.
Real quick, Senator.
Yes, Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. I just wanted to touch base. Will we talk more about PREA and counties and so forth later in the week?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, that I'm not sure that that's in the presentation. I know that as we talk about work release and being able to move individuals into work release programs, that that has come up around PREA compliance. So I'm happy to answer any question you have now.
Okay. How about, thank you, Madam. How about if we wait and have it at that conversation at that time, we'll see what
Perfect.
Is in the presentation. And
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Our internal audits unit is an imperative, another, like the Inspector General's office, an imperative checks and balances inside our agency. They really help us prevent and mitigate risk. Thanks to the leadership of our lead senior auditor, Adrian O'Connor, this office ensures that the agency is following policies and procedures, operating efficiently, and meeting our goals and objectives. Oregon Corrections Enterprise is a semi-independent agency whose administrator is Ken Jeske. OCE trains adults in custody in prison work assignments such as contact centers, wood fabrication, printing, metal fabrication, and industrial laundry. For those of you that don't know, the desks that you sit in inside your office were actually made by inmates from Oregon Corrections Enterprise, as well as many other pieces of furniture throughout this building. These programs really teach specific technical skills, as well as the general soft skills that can be applied to any work environment. I would like to publicly thank Administrator Jeske and his team for their tremendous work over the past 5 years because, as you may remember, he inherited the enterprise at a very difficult time. And operations, sales, and internal morale were plummeting. And yet, as promised, he has turned the agency around. Since January of 2012, OCE has increased the number of inmates assigned to OCE work assignments by 18%, which is pretty phenomenal because that number had remained relatively flat over the previous 8 years. This expansion is really instrumental to our mission as the benefits really go beyond the work skills gained. It allows the adults in our custody to actually earn more. Those are higher paying jobs, which means they can save more for release. They have a better ability to pay victim restitution, child support, and court fees and fines. And again, as I mentioned earlier, they are learning transferable skills that will actually allow them to gain employment upon
release.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these opportunities available at each of the institutions? I think the one I toured and observed was out at OSP, but Deer Ridge and others, are opportunities available within the industry?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Huffman, we have work opportunities at all of our prison locations. We have OCE opportunities at many of our work operations or work sites, and I'll get you a full list of those.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. The agency scope. So the Department of Corrections is responsible for the care and custody of more than 14,600 men and women. They reside in 14 prisons throughout the state. These are individuals who have been convicted of felonies and sentenced to more than 1 year in custody. In the last 2 years, we processed more than 10,000 intakes, and since our population is relatively flatlined, we've released close to 10,000 individuals back into the community. On average, we release about 400 individuals every month. I think it's important to note that 93% of those in our care and custody will ultimately come back to our communities. So it really is an opportunity to make great change with those individuals. We continue to have direct oversight of offenders on community supervision in two counties, in Douglas and Lynn.
Director Peters, you said 93%. I thought that one time that number was 95. Has there been a change because of length of stay, or what's the...
Madam Co-Chair, if it was 95%, it's obviously changed. What I'll do is I'll go back and look and see when it changed. If we are receiving more individuals with life without, that could very well be. So we can go look historically at when that number ticked down.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So we continue to have direct supervision in Lynn and Douglas County for those community corrections offices. And I'd actually like to highlight our restitution collection focus this last year, which we are quite proud of. In those two counties, our officers increased restitution collection by 17%. So while we have a ways to go, I'm really grateful for that focus in those two counties. In addition to the direct oversight of 26 offenders in those two counties, we also have indirect oversight of more than 28,000 adults on felony probation, parole, and post-prison supervision in the remaining 34 counties through the administration of the Community Corrections Grant Program. So now I'd like to turn our attention to the adults who are in our custody. Who are they and what are their needs? Like the rest of the nation, the majority of those in our custody are men. They make up 91% of our prison population. And while women make up just 9% of our population, the female prison population is rising dramatically. Over the last 20 years, we've quadrupled the female prison population. By comparison, during that same time, the male population has also grown, but it's only doubled. So pretty dramatic. This is a national issue. And of course, this has been a very real concern here in Oregon, as our female population has risen above the threshold for reactivating the Oregon State Penitentiary Facility for Women. I will discuss this situation in more detail here in a little bit, but in the meantime, I am happy to report that we've seen the numbers drop a bit. We were at 1288 this morning, and we have two county partners who have started the work release programs in both Marion and Lane County, which is helping to alleviate that pressure at Coffee Creek. As I noted earlier, Assistant Director Heidi Stewart will talk more about these programs later this week, and I'll be at the table with her and happy to answer any questions you might have. Our population is aging, as Madam Co-Chair pointed out. It is the increase in length of stays that is increasing our aging population. While the percentage of those younger than 30 is actually showing a steady decline, those over 45 are growing rapidly. Since 2008, we've seen an increase of 58% in those 46 and older. And as you can imagine, that has a significant impact on our health care, the cost of our health care. And it's important to note that generally speaking, because of the lifestyles that they've lived, because of their lack of preventative care, they actually come to us 10 years older biologically than their chronological age. So those 61 and higher are our highest cost group. As you look at race, unfortunately, like the rest of the nation, Oregon has a disproportionate number of minorities in our criminal justice system. African Americans comprise 2% of Oregon's population, yet they comprise 9% of the prison population. American Indians comprise less than 3% of the prison population, yet they are incarcerated at a rate three times the population in Oregon. If you looked at a breakdown of the type of offenses that result in DOC custody, it shows that the majority are person-to-person crimes at 68%. But if you tease out the data by gender, you see a very different makeup. Among women, 50 to 60% are incarcerated for drug or property crimes, whereas men are close to 20 to 30%. So a very significant difference when you look at gender. So now you know who we have in our care and custody. Now I'd like to talk about how we are doing. As you can see here, there are a number of tools we use to measure our performance. In 2003, the Oregon Legislature passed Senate Bill 267, requiring us to engage in evidence-based programming and cost-effective programming. So from July 2014 to June 2016, there were a total of 35 programs completed on in-prison and community programs. 23 of these evaluations were performed on state general funded programs, and I'm happy to report that all six programs in prison that were evaluated scored satisfactory. I mentioned internal audits briefly before, but again, our internal audits unit lets us know how we're doing. It's a unit that we really rely on because it's an important function that measures our progress and outcomes and helps us prevent and mitigate risks. Since 2014, they have conducted 20 audit engagements. These include compliance audits, financial audits, performance and operational audits, and consultations of various functions throughout the agency. These audit activities help us focus our resources on our high-risk areas and reach our agency objectives. This slide lists examples of audit work recently completed, and I'd like to briefly highlight one. As you know, ethics in state government is receiving more attention than ever, and it should. It is becoming more prevalent nationally as well. My national association, the Association of State Correctional Administrators, actually created a code of conduct for administrators of corrections that we all adhere to. I also had the opportunity of presenting on ethics at the annual conference of the Association of Women Executives in Corrections. So I'm seeing this conversation consistently show up on agendas, both nationally and at home. At home, recognizing the importance of ethics here, especially as a public safety agency, where I think we need to be held to the highest of ethical standards with individuals in our care and custody. For years, each employee has signed a code of ethics, and beyond that, we're now placing an increased focus on ethics within DOC. Last May, we actually invited the Oregon Government Ethics Commission in to provide training to our leadership team. We've actually consulted with them on some of our policies and procedures. We have adopted a formal leadership philosophy and leadership attributes that includes ethics and values, so something that we'll talk about on a regular and daily basis. And we've recently asked our internal audits unit to review our current ethical climate, and they've done that. So to do this, our auditors interviewed and surveyed staff and management and reviewed agency practices, and they have a host of recommendations for us. Leadership training around ethics, clear expectations about ethical behavior, improvement to the code of conduct, and having volunteers and contractors sign statements with regards to ethics. So we want the committee to know that we are working to implement all of the audit's recommendations, and we'll continue to keep ethics on the forefront of our conversations. We also rely on the Secretary of State's office for external audits. These audits are provided in your appendix for your reference. I will highlight that every year the Department of Corrections is part of the statewide comprehensive annual financial report. Again and again, this audit shows that DOC is using proper accounting tools to ensure our largest accounts within the state are appropriately managed. There have been no specific findings to DOC from these audits, and we have and are very proud that we have received the gold star for the last 11 years in a row for good financial reporting. In Oregon, recidivism has historically been defined as any new felony conviction within 36 months of release from prison, or for probationers, any felony conviction within 36 months after beginning probation. However, House Bill 3194 changed the definition of recidivism, and then Senate Bill 3366 in 2015 subsequently revised it ever so slightly. So the current definition of recidivism is expanded. The recidivism is a subsequent arrest, conviction, or incarceration of a person, either 3 years or less from beginning felony probation, or 3 years or less after release from incarceration. I want the committee to know that we are working through the legislative process to update our recidivism KPM to reflect that new definition so that we're measuring that rate the same way. So where do we measure with this new definition? For those that release from prison or from a felony jail sentence in the first 6 months of 2013, 17% were reincarcerated for a new felony crime within 3 years of release. 42% were convicted of a new misdemeanor or felony crime within 3 years of release. And 55% were arrested for a new crime within 3 years of release.
Director, how does that compare with previous, because we just changed the definition, but going back, how does that compare?
So our most recent data show the current recidivism rate on the traditional definition at about 31% for those releasing from our custody, and the probation recidivism rate is at about 25.8% based on the old traditional definition. Thank you. The department's key performance measures reflect the mission, vision, and values of the agency. This chart shows you that we are doing well at meeting most of our self-imposed targets, but as you can see, we still have some areas in which to improve. So for the purposes of my presentation today, you have your KPMs and your attachments, and know that each assistant director will weave those into their presentation when it's relevant to their topic area. I've had the chance to talk to many of you individually about the work we have engaged in the past several years around our performance-based management system. We affectionately refer to this management system as CORE, and that acronym stands for Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement. And it is allowing us to become more transparent and outcome-based. And really, we're hoping to create a culture where all employees who are actually close to the problem feel empowered to fix the problem. As an example, a team was formed to address the low numbers of adults in custody, releasing with birth certificates and replacement Social Security cards. And I am sure this committee can imagine both are critical to someone's successful transition. So you won't be pleased with the original numbers. In 2013, AICs releasing with both Social Security replacement cards and birth certificates was only 4.7%. We've increased that now at the end of fiscal year 2016 to 37%. So we hope to continue to grow that number, but that's a very significant increase in a short period of time. And it really is based on a seven-step problem-solving team that we put together that came out of our performance-based management system. Now, this slide gives you an idea of what our scorecard looks like. You have the scorecard in its entirety in your packet. We're measuring over 108 measures, so this really is just a snapshot. As an agency, we're measuring everything from the number of AICs completing with GEDs to staff wellness to training and to DOC team member grievances. And the scorecard keeps us in tune to our daily operations. That is, in our mind, who we are, that's how we operate, but what are our issues and where do we want to take the agency? And that's our 10-year strategic plan. We're referring to that plan as Destination 2026, which helps us keeps us forward thinking to our future state. This plan is really helping us solidify our organizational identity and culture for years to come. Ultimately, we want the Department of Corrections to become the public safety employer of choice, with employees who come to work every day knowing that they can change lives. And by lives, I mean the adults in our custody and that of each other.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We hear from industry all the time that they really lack qualified applicants for employment. How is the department doing in that regard? Are you successfully recruiting qualified applicants on a regular basis, or is it getting kind of skinny?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Huffman, great question. I'm going to talk about that a little bit under the Pride and Skills section of
this. I'm happy
to
wait.
So it's a great segue, actually. We'll go into that right now because it is skinny. So while every agency, and as you mentioned, Representative Huffman, the private sector organization is faced with challenges, we're all faced with an aging and retirement eligible workforce. And it's even higher at the Department of Corrections because 20 to 25 years ago, we built all of these new prisons. We hired professionals and they stayed with us their entire career. And now they're retirement eligible. And the statistics are pretty dramatic. 35% of these staff are eligible to retire right now. In the next 5 years, 54% of our staff are eligible to retire. So more than half of my workforce. And let me tell you, they're all watching very closely as you have PERS conversations, no doubt. So this road, as we talk about this, really is talking about instilling pride in our staff, helping the public understand the value of corrections professionals, providing world-class training, and recruiting the best and the brightest. Because traditionally, to Representative Huffman's point, we've really just waited for people to come to the agency, see who came, filled out the application. If they passed their criminal background check, we took them. We traditionally haven't been great about getting into the communities of color, getting into college campuses to really drum up our recruiting efforts. And as you all know, we have a crisis in hiring and public safety across the country. And so that's no different here at the Department of Corrections. And we have some very specific initiatives to help address that.
Yes, follow up, Representative Huffman. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you define your words were something to the effect of, we haven't been very good at getting into, or I assume in attracting. Can you elaborate a bit? What do you do for recruitment to try to get ethnic diversity?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Huffman, before the Great Recession, we had a recruitment team that went out and got into the communities, got onto college campuses, and were part of recruitment fairs. And we put those on hold during budget reductions. And so we just now are putting our recruitment team together. We're leaning into social media pretty substantially to get our message out and to reach those communities. We have, once again, are getting our teams out to the communities of color for recruitment, getting onto those college campuses to really do proactive recruitment. But I would say, Representative, for probably 8 years, it really was reactive, just who was coming to us, and now we're really turning it and becoming more proactive.
Thank you.
It's going to take, just to follow along that line, having been around for some time, particularly the landscape of Oregon, and you're trying to recruit people from across this country. There's a lot more issues, and Colette will have to deal with by herself. I'll just say that. And I'm sure that Irving Sanchez understands as well. It's both a culture and how we are in what exists in Oregon and what we look like in Oregon. And so there's a huge challenge, not only for in the field of corrections, but in other fields as well. And I'm going to pile on a little bit more, because I know that in the whole public safety arena, and looking across this country, and with the, and I think I can get a yes from Peluso and Representative Barker, that this whole thing of public safety and how we have actually across this country have viewed the role of public safety has not been the best in the world either. And so there's some real challenges in recruitment and getting individuals to come into the field. There is the challenge of making certain that we have the training abilities and what have you. I just need to, for the record, say that. It's an issue that I know throughout law enforcement that it's being discussed.
Madam Co-Chair, that's absolutely correct. And it really, that part of the conversation really drove our vision for our 10-year plan to become that public safety employer of choice. So with this public safety crisis across the country, if we really kind of leveraged the mission that we have and enticed those millennials and those individuals who are looking for employment to really latch on to a mission-driven agency, we really think that over the next 10 years with these, the initiatives that were up just a second ago, the workforce planning, the developing leaders, developing managers, kind of our talent strategy around recruitment, that we could actually leverage this situation is our hope.
Yes.
So do you seek out like the people in social work? I mean, it would seem like that would be a good fit for people that are interested in helping others and to go in and obviously your benefits are much better than the nonprofits can provide for those.
Absolutely. Madam Co-Chair, Representative Barker, our contractors who contract with mental health, alcohol, and drug, they're often a great recruitment pool as they come in and do contract work inside our institution, and then we're able to steal them. I think that's a great source. The military has been a great source for recruitment for us, stepping in, and retail, customer service related jobs. When I meet with our group of cadets when they're getting ready to graduate and I kind of poll, where did you come from? How did you think about coming to corrections? It's often split into those two categories primarily.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm, thank you. So we can't get to that destination 2026 without our employees. Staff wellness is our top agency initiative. I've talked to each of you about it individually. You know I am passionate about this, and I'm passionate about it because it's really personal. I was drawn to this field because it is a changing field. Representative Barker, as you said, that social work background, you believe in humanity, you believe people can change. And so I've spent my entire career working with juveniles, victims, adults in custody, And yet during my 25-year career, we didn't spend time focusing on helping the professionals who were doing the helping. And when I became director 5 years ago, in less than an 18-month period, we grieved the loss of 4 of our team members to suicide, and they've continued. So OHSU and PSU came in to DOC to study our wellness, or lack thereof, and as Assistant Director Daryl Borello pointed out during the grant application presentation, the results are alarming. After 20 years in the business, your life expectancy is 58. 1 in 3 of our staff have symptoms of PTSD. We are physically overweight with high blood pressure and poor medical markers. And it's all because we are in the state of hypervigilance, and it doesn't leave when you leave the prison. So while our staff don't get assaulted every day, thank God, they come to work knowing that they can. So we've taken this research, we've developed a breakthrough initiative team, which is a strategic team, and have been addressing the issue. So here's what we've done so far. We've collected good data. We are educating our team on the inherent risks to working in corrections. We have wellness programs across the state, including the introduction of meditation, which was mentioned earlier. When you look at PEB members, all PEB members across the state, we are the highest participant in the Healthy Team, Healthy You program. And Snake River is our highest facility participant, participating at the rate of 73%. So we continue to beat that drum and continue to get people signed up for that program. Given your blessing and that of Full Ways and Means, we are applying for an NIJ grant to pilot another program and study the results, as you talked about earlier. And last but not least, I want to point out that one of our top goals in this area is to reduce mandatory overtime, because we know that that can kill our staff, recognizing the stress this puts on them. So our 10-year goal is to reduce mandatory overtime by 20%. Our goal within the first 4 years is to reduce by 20%. Every organization needs to keep its pulse on its culture, and I think that's even more important at the Department of Corrections when we're charged with the behavior change of violent and serious offenders. We better pay attention to the culture. So we are starting to address this by first collecting data about culture in order to determine all of our next steps. Our wellness data suggested out of PSU that individuals actually feel less stressed when they believe their frontline manager values them and values their family. Pretty simple, pretty human. So on this road, we know we want to place an emphasis on valuing employees and families, and have begun piloting family night at some of our institutions for new and senior staff. We also know that we must focus on manager and leadership development and training in order to enhance our culture. But beyond that, we're really going to rely on the data and leverage the initiative team's work to figure out next steps in this area. So we believe this focus will help us really strengthen our culture of employees treating each other with respect. Next is correction outcomes. You all have heard me talk about some of the positive outcomes we have experienced in Oregon's public safety communities. We have low recidivism rates, safe prisons, and evidence-based programs. And we recognize we can and should do better. So this area is all about increasing positive outcomes. We'll be focusing on safe and secure workplaces, ensuring adults in custody are placed in the right housing situations, modernizing technology, and ultimately reducing future victimization. Some of the initiatives in this area will include completing a gap analysis to determine first the needs of the inmate population compared to the services we actually provide, and then figuring out the gap and how we're going to address that gap. We also are going to analyze programmatic and space needs to predict the agency's future facility needs based on that gap analysis and our mission. So throughout my career, I have always been a believer in the obligation to help people prepare for successful reentry back to the community. So on this reentry and supervision road to Destination 2026, we're focusing on ensuring that those in our custody are meeting the goals of their case plan, ensuring evidence-based programs are meeting identified criminogenic needs, and that those in custody and those on supervision pay towards their court-ordered financial obligations. And we'll talk about more about that during the legislative slide. And, of course, all of this should lead to a reduction in future victimization and successful transition. So now that I've taken you out 10 years, we can get back to today, which leads me to the next topic, legislation. We have 12 agency bills, and committee members, I will tell you, for the most part, they are technical in nature, so unless you have questions, I won't go over them today. I know that my team has been checking in with you when they've appeared before committee. But I would like to mention briefly, as I just mentioned restitution, one Senate Judiciary bill because it ties to our initiative around restitution. Senate Bill 844 is the result of the Inmate Financial Accountability Work Group. This was a group that DOC chaired and staffed, and that included a diverse group of stakeholders, all with one goal: to develop a system whereby DOC can collect a portion of inmate monies to go toward court-ordered financial obligations, such as victim restitution, compensatory fines and fees, and court fines and fees. So while this is not a DOC bill, it is something really important to our agency, and I'm so pleased that we were able to collectively get together to develop a workable solution. This slide gives an overview of the governor's recommended budget, which includes $1.7 billion in total funds and about 4,600 FTE. The table also shows how our total budget is broken down by division and major program areas. The bulk of our budget goes to three distinct but not surprising program areas. The first are our prisons at 47% of our budget, health services at 15%, and community corrections at another 15% of our budget. You'll also note that the bulk of our staff work in the operations division at about 85%. So finally, while this table shows our total funds budget, as was mentioned earlier, 95% is from the general fund. There are several major budget drivers for the agency. The first is staff, salaries, benefits, and retirement. This is by far our biggest expense, and it is necessary and critical. We are a people organization. We hire people to maintain the care and custody over people. Facilities and infrastructure. As our facilities age, their maintenance becomes a budget driver. Even with our new facilities, with the rapid advancement in technology, the modern correctional systems integrated into our newer facilities, and our newer facilities are already 10 to 25 years old, which will reach the end of their life cycle more quickly and require replacement. So our current capital improvement and renewal estimate is $215 million. From that total, we identified the most critical priority needs, just those in the health, safety, and security categories, and that totals $142 million. Out of that, $32.5 million is funded in the governor's budget. So you can see that the need is great and the funds are low. Now the slide that many of you have been wanting to focus on. As you know, based on the actual and forecasted female population, the governor's budget did include monies to operate OSPM in the 17-19 biennium. I'm going to talk about the female and male populations in more detail in the next two slides, but just quickly, I'm pleased that we've been able to relatively safely manage the growth of the inmate population by using temporary and emergency beds across the state. But we did that with no additional staff resources. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this makes me nervous. We currently have 880 activated emergency beds across the system. That includes 120, that's in addition to 122 for women at Coffee Creek. The risk to staff and those in our custody increases when we do this. So it cannot be a long-term solution. Based on our current projected end of biennium deficit and also facing the potential programming shortfall in the 17-19 governor's recommended budget, we recently made the decision to end four programs. This is the first time that we've had to cut programs in several biennia, and it certainly was a difficult decision. This slide shows the population projection for the male population over a 10-year period. You'll note that the orange line, the orange flat line, represents when we would need to open additional capacity at Deer Ridge. And that's when we hit 13,700 men, and that's in June of 2022. And the purple flat line shows when we would need to open Junction City. Based on the current forecast, the good news is that that is really pushed out beyond the 10-year forecasting period. While the additional 100 beds at Shutter Creek aren't shown on the slide, based on the forecast, in September of this year, we will fill 50 already constructed beds, and then we'll fill the remaining 50 in July of 2019. Before I get to the female population, as you look at these numbers, I think it's so important to note that justice reinvestment is working, because even though we're asking for additional beds, what we actually would have been asking for before is dramatically different. So if you look at pre-3194, and that's the red line that you see on this chart, and you can see how it's going up, up, up. Deer Ridge would have been fully opened in March of 2015. Shutter Creek would have been fully opened in March of last year. And Junction City would be finishing construction, and you would all have been invited to a ribbon cutting ceremony next month. So that is a big difference in terms of the growth that was projected and the reality today. So I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to publicly thank our public safety partners for their work on justice reinvestment. I think you've heard me say this, I'll say it again and again, one of the best outcomes of 3194 and justice reinvestment was the coming together of the public safety system and the strong collaboration that we've built. So our hope is that future forecasts based on this collaboration and the work happening at the local level will continue to keep Junction City outside of that 10-year window. Now, the female population. Based on the housing capacity for the female population at Coffee Creek, we've always recommended the activation of OSPM when the female population reaches a sustained 1280. Our actual and October forecast, which projects the women's population to remain above 1280 for the remainder of the 10-year forecast. So in December, when we requested funding from the E-Board to reactivate OSPM, the actual female population had exceeded the 1280 threshold every day for 7 months, reaching 1315 on November 18th of last year. The forecast says the number will peak at 1337 throughout the 17-19 biennium, and that is to happen in June of this year. Today, we have seen the population hovering right below 1300. I told you this morning we were at 1288. We also have several counties who have stepped up to implement work release programs to help alleviate the pressure at Coffee Creek. Marion County's program is up and running. Lane County is currently screening participants, and we're in discussions with Jackson County on a potential program that could actually house Jackson, Josephine, and Klamath County releases. Again, Assistant Director Heidi Stewart will talk about more of these programs later this week. We'll talk about these programs later this week.
Steiner Hayward, Senator has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Peters, you may have mentioned this when I had to be out of the room to testify, but you showed us a slide of some of the infinite numbers of bills that are sort of in your bailiwick this year, and you only talked specifically about one of them. Do you believe that there are bills that you think are plausible that could have a real impact on our prison populations? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but in ways that you don't think would have a substantial detriment to public safety. I mean, obviously, we don't want to compromise public safety to save prison beds. That's not our goal. But do you believe that there are potentially some bills that could help potentially advance the work of justice reinvestment or in other ways address our rising prison population so that we don't have to keep expanding?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator, The 12 bills that I listed were the bills that the agency pushed forward, and they really were technical in nature, so I didn't want to waste the committee's valuable time to go through those. Absolutely, I think there are some great conversations happening out there right now, conversations around AIP, around short-term trans leave, around the Family Sentencing Alternative Program. I think that all of those conversations could potentially lead to a greater impact at DOC. I think the one that rises to the top of the list for me is justice reinvestment and funding that program and continuing to fund that program, because I truly believe that getting those services on the front end and on the back end are going to be the long-term hope for the system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the flip side, you know, we're this body is not adverse to actually adding to the sentencing that increases the likelihood of individuals going through the court system and ending up at DOC. I just need to put that out there. We have a propensity for also introducing legislation and what have you that has a chilling effect sometimes on DOC. So there's two pieces to this, these hydraulics. One is the initiative to try to keep individuals from going in, and also when they come out to assure that they don't go back in. That's those initiatives. And then there are those who think that maybe we don't send them in long enough. So,
thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So as required, we put forth 15% reduction options. These were not included in the 17-19 governor's budget, but I will go over a few of note. Deactivating 10 institutions and releasing over 6,000 offenders. However, currently I do not have statutory authority to release offenders prior to their calculated sentence completion date. So this strategy is only possible if statutory change occurred. Cuts to treatment programming and community corrections were part of our budget reduction option. However, philosophically, we know that would erode all the good work we've done to make Oregon one of the best correctional systems in the country.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what would the impact be on the community corrections piece from a cost savings perspective if you had multiple counties give community corrections back to the state? At what point do you not save money anymore?
Co-chairs and Representative Huffman, in the governor's balanced budget, there is a 5% reduction to community corrections, and we believe that that will trigger opt-out. How many counties will opt out in that scenario is unknown. We are guessing that the timber counties will be some of the first counties to call us. I don't know that it is more cost effective to have the state run community corrections. I think philosophically, I believe in 1145, I believe in local control. And in fact, we may be able to take one or two smaller counties here without much increase to our administrative staff. But beyond that, there'll be a tipping point. There'll be a tipping point where I'll need more administrative staff, I'll need more payroll, more accounting, more HR managers, more investigators and SIU. And so I think it does come at a cost.
Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm puzzled by one thing. I'm looking back at your slide numbers, please, that shows the governor's budget, the 2017-19 governor's budget, and you talk about operations and health services together being about $1 billion, right? And that's for the 14,400 inmates that you listed earlier on in the previous slide, right? But then the reduction slide says that if you reduced by 42%, which is what 6,000 is of 14,000, that you'd only save $1.175 million, which is not 42% of $1 billion. So I realize that you have to maintain certain staffing levels, but if you shut down I'm a little puzzled by the proportionality. I realize there are economies of scale, but that doesn't seem, you're talking about 17% as opposed to 42%, which is what you'd be reducing the inmate population by.
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Robbins. I'm the chief financial officer for the Department of Corrections. Senator Steiner Haywood, the answer there really comes with which institutions we're talking about closing. We've got some, as Senator Winters speaks of them, as cities around the state. Some of these cities are very large cities. If you look at an Ontario at a Snake River, that, for instance, was one of the institutions we would not be closing in a scenario like this. Huge number of staff, whereas some of the institutions we are talking about would be a Mill Creek or some of the little smaller ones. So it is actually a matter of economies of scale, but it's primarily because we chose to try and in a reduction plan like this, talk about those institutions that have ancillary costs associated with them. They're farther out. We're doing a lot more transporting, a lot more distribution to those. And so in the end, the institutions that are the really big, stalwart institutions are the ones that stay in the mix. And that's primarily the reason.
All right. Thank you. I was just puzzled by those numbers. That's great.
And just to add some context, and I do refer to them as 14 cities, because when you actually look at them and where they are distributed around the state, they also are an economic engine to those particular communities that they where they're housed and where they live. So I refer to them as cities because it's more than just the brick and mortar with individuals inside of that brick and mortar, because the economy that the prison industry provides is to that community and city there. So my reference to cities is because I think the majority of them are 1,000 plus, if I get my math right. So, and then you start adding staff and others and the individuals who come to visit the individuals in those cities and those communities, then we're talking more than just the dollars and cents that impacts the budget of DOC, but the implication and the impacts on those communities in which those facilities reside.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. That ends my portion of the presentation. So I would like to invite Assistant Director Michael Gower up to the table, if that pleases the committee.
Thank you so much. He's been sitting back patiently waiting because I called him earlier.
So, I was going to come up, Senator.
So as he comes up, I would note that this is an individual who has 33 years in public safety, 10 years in Massachusetts, which will be represented in his accent here in a minute, 9 years with the Oregon State Police, and now 14 years at the Department of Corrections. And he is charged with our operations division. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Gower.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and co-chair Stock. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Gower. I am the administrator, the assistant director, for the operations division. The operations division has four administrative units. I will be talking about three of them. The health services administrator, Joe Defoe, will be following me tomorrow, so he'll be able to talk about all the medical, mental health, the doctor, dentist, and pharmacy operations in more specific detail and to answer any of your questions. So I'll be presenting about the institutions, the chief of security, and our central service unit that helps run our 14 cities. The operations division has a small central administrative staff, which is responsible for management oversight of all division employees, which includes the guiding of four labor contracts, setting policies, rules, and procedures, management of staff scheduling, oversight of the food service for our AIC work programs within our prisons, and responding to stakeholders, including our adults in custody, families, community organizations, legislators, or other government entities. Next slide. Thank you. Running the day-to-day operation in our correctional facilities absorbs 49% of our agency general fund budget. This includes the feeding, clothing, and providing safety and personal needs for more than the 14,600 men and women each day. As the director stated, in this slide, you're looking at the operations division, our FTE in comparison to the rest of the agency. The operations division contains 72.5% of the workforce. Our major budget drivers, the director alluded to a few of them. Staff compensation is our major budget driver for our division. The department has fixed post obligations, meaning the work in these posts is not optional, and these posts must be staffed regardless of the circumstances. Occasionally, overtime is less costly than new staff. However, chronic overtime does put stress on existing staff and ends up costing us more money. A key factor to this amount of overtime necessary to operate our facilities is an outdated post relief factor that is due to contractual, regulatory, administrative increases in time away from the post. Medical costs are influenced by a number of factors, including the health of the adults in our custody, their age, their medical needs of the population, and the extent that which meets the inmates' medical needs within DOC and new medical treatments that become standard within the community. And Mr. Defoe will talk more about that. One of the things that does impact the...
Chris Stark.
Thank you, Coach Winters. Sorry, can we go back one? I'm trying to translate your statement about the overtime on... You had a statement that sounded nice and fancy, but will you translate that for me again? On the overtime and the with salaries and benefits and
sure.
So forth.
Co-chair Stark, what we're trying to say is most of the posts that are in the institutions are fixed posts, so the prison's operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. Most of those posts are have to be filled, and when we do that, if someone calls in sick or they have vacation time or training or something that takes them away from that post, we have to fill it. We do have people that are assigned to relieving that. When a bunch of folks do call in sick, then we have to hire overtime. Sometimes people are voluntary overtime. They'll sign up for that. Other time we have mandatory, where we call it a bucket list, where you're actually obligated to work that overtime. And over the years, since we've developed the program for the relief factor, a lot more regulatory or administrative factors have come into that. So folks now have bereavement leave. We have leaves that pertain to protecting people with domestic violence, OFLA, FMLA. Some of those obligations that now are awarded to our employees weren't factored into our relief factor back in the day when we did that many years ago. So it's been outdated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have employees that are hired specifically for on-call? I mean, working in residential back in the day, we would run into the same thing. People calling sick, you have to call somebody in. But there were a lot of days off that you could predict, you know, like FMLA and so forth. And so they had a handful of employees that they would hire that their schedule would change weekly, because it was an on-call schedule. And they could say yes or no. They had the ability to say that in scheduling. And then they would also get called in for those other shifts. But that cut down on the amount of overtime on individuals. Do you guys do that?
Co-chair Stock, so we don't have people that we call in. We do have the relief factor. So if we have a post that has to be filled 7 days a week, we'll hire one person for that post, actually five people for that post, and one of them will be a relief to cover when people are off. The problem is when you have a bunch of people that might have the flu, or you have training, you have multiple absences that we can't occur. So the relief that we've built into that will cover for most of the circumstances. But unfortunately, we have a lot of times that we have multiple posts where people are unable to cover. So that's where we ask for volunteers. And if not, you might have worked a day shift, and if people called in sick and we don't have coverage for it, the supervisor will tell Mr. Stock, Representative Stock, you're going to have to work today, unfortunately, and cover this shift because we weren't able to have anyone else come in.
Thank you, Senator. So one more question on that, and this was a fairly new conversation that came up the other day as far as the PERS spiking, I think that's what they called it, the idea of we're intentionally but not necessarily reporting that occasionally there in the past have been individuals who, you know, hey, I call in sick this week, and or what was it called, PERS spiking, you know, or one person calls in sick 1 week so that somebody else covers the overtime, and then the next week they kind of alternate. Are you guys seeing that much anymore? Because I know that in the past, or at least I heard that in the past, you were seeing some of that.
Well, we would hope our staff wouldn't be doing that. We would hope that's not the case, but we do have some institutions that, and I don't want to guess on the specific number, but I know at Coffee Creek, on a particular one-day, 24-hour schedule, we had dozens of folks that were mandatoried on each of the shifts because of certain either sick time or training opportunities or vacations, whatever it might have been. Hospital watches, when DOC cannot meet our medical treatment needs with our adults in custody, they need to be sent to health care providers in our community. Depending on the security level of the inmate, at least one or two of our staff have to escort these adults in our custody into the community. And if it does turn into an overnight stay, that again, we have to provide security 24 hours a day, and sometimes that is two staff per one of our adults, which can, again, this is something that usually we can't count on. It's just one of these things that happens.
I know that you don't have electronic records yet, but you know that I'm interested in the geriatric population. And for the record, there's about 175 inmates, one of which is a female, that are over the ages of 75. I'm interested in the health status of that population and whether or not we should be looking at centralization. Is there some way that we can actually begin looking at where they're located, or in the 14 cities, and begin to do some cost analysis of whether or not centralization would be a better plan.
Let me take that.
Sure.
Madam Co-Chair, so internal to our organization, we have tried to cluster these individuals with high a health need or geriatric need inside our existing structure. As you know, out of 3194, we also reviewed and analyzed the cost effectiveness of opening up OSPM as an example as a geriatric facility. And what we were able to determine in that analysis is that it would actually be more cost effective to create a new facility as opposed to make that one ADA compliant. I think Junction City was ultimately intended to help with our special needs population, including our geriatric and chronic disease population. So the good news is Junction City has moved outside of the 10-year window. The bad news is a new facility structure that we kind of had our hearts set on to help manage some of these more difficult populations is pushed out beyond the 10-year window.
I still would like to have some profiling and some analysis of the population, particularly looking at the issue that we're not getting younger inside the institution, and it is population that's, based on your stats, it's growing older, and somehow we're going to have to address this.
Good looking at me.
I'm only looking because you and I went through this in Angola.
Yeah,
true. The two of us were in Angola, and you guys didn't know we spent three whole days, wasn't it?
In prison.
Yeah. And that program, actually, in looking at the population that I'm referring to there, was the ability to have hospice, and also you had kind of like a facility where, anyway. So I'm still very much interested in looking at some of the profiles, and I'll get back to you later on it.
Madam Co-Chair, so we'll talk about the details of the analysis later. Okay, thank you.
Within the cost increases, Director, I thought picked up on the two issues, our aging facilities as well as our new ones still needing to be updated with their integrated technology, so I won't go back over that. The daily cost of providing clothing, laundry, and personal supplies such as toilet paper and basic hygiene items to our adults in custody within our budget is an ongoing challenge for our operations division. The department has studied our use of these items and services and made a concerted effort to modify our practices to control these costs. I mentioned that we do run some of the safest and most secure prisons in the country. However, disturbances do occur when We follow a number of leading indicators to monitor the climate within our institutions, taking steps to diffuse these situations before they become disruptive. But when something does happen unexpectedly, such as an inmate death or a conflict between rival groups, it can involve significant staff time and resources to bring the institution back into order. Here is our prison locations. As the co-chair Winters said, our cities, we span pretty much all four corners of the state, with our smallest work unit is at South Fork and Tillamook with 200 beds, and our biggest unit is Ontario at Snake River that has 3,000 beds. It should also be noted now more than half of our beds are located on the east side of the state, and majority of our population actually comes from the Willamette Valley. Coffee Creek in Wilsonville serves as a dual purpose. It is Oregon's only female institution, and it also contains our intake center that serves all adults who enter into our custody. Maintaining a growing female population at Coffee Creek has stretched the institution's capacity level. That elevates our concern, and the director did a very nice job earlier explaining the issues. The most important thing that we strive for is to run safe and secure prisons. We're proud that we are recognized for doing this well, but we must remain vigilant, and we're always trying to improve. And it's important to note, because of the great job our team does in keeping us safe, that we're able to have other conversations about programming, treatment, education, visiting, and all the other things that we know that help our adults make better decisions to not recidivate. Pictured here, we have some rooms with our male and female facilities that allow us to offer programming to our violent and mentally ill adults in a manner that we haven't been able to in the past. These programming chairs are part of revisions to the restrictive housing that allow us more interaction with program providers and socialization for these adults. The operations division has taken the lead on a breakthrough initiative to optimize the use of special housing beds. A principal focus will be long-term effective placement of special housing as an inmate tool. In March of 2015, we were selected to participate in a safe alternative to segregation project with the Vera Institution and DOJ. Over the current biennium, we received technical assistance focused on analyzing the use of segregated housing and developing recommendation of its safe reduction. Vera's recommendations came out to ODOT in October of 2016. DOC is currently reviewing and prioritizing these recommendations and has entered into an agreement with Vera to obtain assistance with the implementation of these recommendations through a secondary grant from BJA. Also pictured here on the bottom left, we spoke to you back in 2015 about the Blue Room at Snake River that was profiled in Time Magazine. It's another recommendation from Vera Report that we expand this Blue Room concept to all our special housings across the state. Up on the top left, you'll see Heidi from Transport. She is one of our newest TERT female team members. DOC has made changes to our tactical response team management model to develop consistency and expertise. We've also enhanced the ability for females to seek TERT assignments and to be successful in training for and being selected to be part of these teams. Key performance measure number five, work crew walkaways. On an average, the department has approximately 420 adults on work crews daily. During the fiscal year 15-16, the department unfortunately had six adults who made very poor choices to walk away from our outside work crews, which came to an average of 0.5 or half per month. Although this is under our target of one for the key performance measure, each incident of an adult walkaway is thoroughly reviewed to identify measures, security practices, training that can be addressed to prevent these future walkaways. KPM 9, unarmed perimeter escapes. This is from our minute.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Winters. So I'm assuming that you were able to collect these individuals and bring them back. If they walked away.
Co-chair Stock, yes. I was going to kind of tie this in together because between the six walkaways and the four unarmed perimeter escapes, I was happy to report that all 10 are back in our custody. The longest was out for 12 days. The shortest was for 3 hours.
Oh, goodness.
While the escapes are rare with our secure custody facility.
Are there additional sanctions when they do that?
Co-Chair Winters, yes, there is. There is the potential for additional criminal penalties as well as sanctions from within.
Just for the record.
Thank you, Senator. So during this time period, we did have four escapes from our minimum facilities. As I said, just with the walkaways, we do a thorough review of those escapes as well to bring in, or I should say, to identify any deficiencies that we can do to have any possible corrective actions. We do have 4,555 minimum beds across the agency, and as I did say, all 10 are back into custody. We have KPM4 assaults on staff. The rate of Class 1 staff assaults decreased this fiscal year to 1.31 assaults, and this is per 1,000 employees, down from the 163 prior reporting period. That equates to 64, which is one too many. The department's recent efforts to develop performance measures had led to routine analysis on the way we accept our data. This was one that we didn't feel comfortable that we were gathering the data correctly, so we put a team together to establish common language definitions, develop a system for data retrieval, and developed and delivered the training on pulling this data to make it more accurate. So we went from 95 from the previous reporting period down to 64. KPM 7, inmate sanctions for level one misconducts. Again, we didn't meet this KPM for the 2016 reporting period. During this period, we had rival groups, four of them, which were involved in four different disturbances that elevated these numbers in the categories of disturbances, assaults, and unauthorized organization. Food matters to our safety and security in our prisons. It's a major form of a management tool, and nutrition can either have a positive or a negative impact on our health care cost. Each day, we plan and prepare 43,000 meals that are served by DOC staff with the assistance from our adults in care. That's over 30 million meals served during the biennium. On a current average daily meal cost, our current daily meal cost is $2.52. That's $2.52 to provide three square meals a day to our adults in custody. The food costs are kept low because of the economies of scale during the purchasing. We are proud of the quality and diversity of our meals. All our menus are certified by a registered dietitian, are consistent from institution to institution, and can be modified for medical or religious needs. Each institution has its own physical plant and dedicated staff to ensure immediate response in case of emergencies and timely response for non-emergencies. The physical plant staff perform day-to-day maintenance, repair, construction work with the assistance from our adults in custody. These include carpentry, electrical work, general maintenance, painting, plumbing, and ground maintenance. Some of these trades are apprenticeship programs where our adults can gain certifications in trades such as electrical and welding. Assistant Director Heidi Stewart will talk more about her presentations in the days to come. Institutions also have embraced recycling and other sustainability programs to great effect, reducing garbage costs and improving our utility efficiencies. Daryl Borello, who spoke to you earlier, he'll have more to talk about that during his presentation, but most of these are being achieved through our physical plant staff. Our transportation unit is an integral part of our prison operations, and it is no small task. We transport our adults for a variety of reasons, including medical appointment, court appointments, housing and security management, program needs, interstate compact transfers, and coordination of new intakes from our county facilities. In 2015-16, even though the number of inmates requiring medical treatment outside our facilities continued to increase, we were able to continue to reduce the number of these trips taken. In 2016, we also turned our attention to those adults who required medical attention outside our state. In this previous year of 2015-16, I have some figures, performance measures that the transport unit performed very well. We reduced the amount of out-of-state trips by 60. So we do have adjoining, we have EO in Pendleton and Two Rivers and Umatilla and Snake River. A lot of our medical trips have to go out either to Washington or to Idaho because we're unable to perform those duties. So we were able to reduce our out-of-trips by 60, reduce the medical trips in-state by 57, and that was a coordinated effort working with our health services and transport to reduce that, which saved us 15,800 miles. Some other performance measures that we're proud of, the transport unit performed 36,000 adults in custody transfers. They performed over 13,000 medical trips. They traveled 1.3 million miles. And during this time period, they threw 30 times on commercial airlines when they were part of an extradition or the compact process for over 480,000 miles with no incidents. Knock on wood.
I think we're going to finish with transportation because we're getting close, and not unless you just have something else quickly that you want to tell us.
Co-chairs, I'm looking forward to coming back tomorrow.
I thought you would. Yes,
what slide number did we get to?
Transportation.
Nine.
I'm on 14 for me.
49 is what?
Yes.
49?
49.
She was almost there.
Almost. All my questions, we fell short. Sorry.
No, not at all. Co-chairs.
So if you didn't get your questions asked, write them down, and tomorrow when we come back, save them, because I know that they'll be here to answer them for you. I don't think that they're going to go to Snake River in our...
Never know.
No plan.
Co-chairs, we'll be back here all week. Thank you, members. Appreciate it very much.
And with that, we are adjourned.